Okay, hi everybody. Let's have a go at this and we'll see how we go. Just get comfortable, just like Carolinas. Feel at ease in the seat. Get grounded. Relax the shoulders. Okay, so imagine all the bodhisattvas, the Buddhas, are surrounding you in space, and you're surrounded by all sentient beings. You imagine the ground beneath you completely pure, made of lapis lazuli light, very soft. While the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas surround you in space, there are also offerings and rainbows. And there is a throne, and Lama Tsongkhapa is sitting on that throne. Now you remember how lucky you are to be still alive today and have the leisure and opportunity to attain your spiritual goal. But you have to act now. Things do not exist in the way they seem to. And though they're not quite right, we do have a spiritual friend who is leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. So imagining yourself to be as clear as a deity holding a vajra and bell. You're going to make the offering of practice purely for the benefit of all sentient beings. And so you say, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So from the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa and all the refuge beings, our lights and nectar stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. Negative karmas and obstructions are clarified, purified. Your lifespan and your virtue and your realizations are increased. And you recollect the four immeasurable and the boundless thoughts. You decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in those four states. And so you say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Again, lights and nectars stream from the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa and the enlightened beings surrounding him. These lights and nectars dissolve into yourself and all beings surrounding you. And negative karmas and obstructions are washed away. Your lifespan is increased, along with your virtue and Dharma realizations. So you relax just a little more. The field for accumulating merit appears. And you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now prevent ourselves from clinging to the practices we've done. Imagine that you're body, your virtues, and your enjoyments are all transformed into a pure land. And you want to offer this to the Buddha, to Lama Tsongkhapa, and to all the entourage. And so you say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as in Buddha Field and offered. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnayatayami. The offering has been released and it's been accepted by Lama Tsongkhapa, and he smiles at you. And you look up into his face and meet his gaze. You feel a great acceptance, a sense of warmth, and a great sense of humility coming from the Lama. Then from the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa, light rays fill the 10 directions of space. These reach all environments and all beings. You all dissolve into light and are gathered up into the field of merit. And this field of merit dissolves into Lama Tsongkhapa, who moves through space, comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, and in diminishing in size, descends, enters the crown of your head, and comes down to your heart. The mind of the Lama, your guru, and your mind become of one singular nature. And within that nature, you hear the mantra. So you start to recite it. Om Guru Vajradhara Sumati Kirti Siddhi Hum. 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 Now from your heart, rays of light fill the 10 directions of space. All beings are utterly transformed, adopting forms of pure enlightenment. You've accomplished the two purposes. And as the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space and re-enters your heart, you can feel your own body breathing itself. Sounds become apparent. And you recognize this meditation was one of imagination, which has imprinted the mind with this possibility of full awakening for yourself and all beings. So then think that, you know, we need to do more than just imagine this. We need to actually engage in the path. We need to develop renunciation, bodhicitta, and a correct view, and find an authentic teacher that will help us create all the stages of the path. I think this is what you want to do. And through studying the Lam Room, this is just part of that desire for awakening. And now breathing deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. And let your eyes flutter open if they're closed. Okay, so we've got a big class today. We've got like 19 questions. So I don't know why I didn't break this into two sections, so we'll just have to see how we go. Now, again, it's sort of broken up into three parts. We begin by looking at the actual object to be negated, and we'll have a look at the conventional versus ultimate. And finally, we've got these misinterpretations that we need to deal with. So there are tenet systems that have particular views about what is to be negated. And so that's what we sort of talked about in this class today. So let's begin with the first question. And here we're talking about this object to be negated. So the question is, what difference is there in the way that the middle way autonomists and the middle way consequentialists identify the object to be negated? So, Bruce, would you like to have a go at that first?
Consequentialists say that inherent existence, existence by way of one's own character and existence from one's own side, are what is to be negated. And autonomists say that phenomena do conventionally exist inherently by their own character and from their own side.
That's right, that's right. So does anybody like to add anything more to that, or is this sort of clear to everybody? These two different objects. So for the middle way autonomous, right, they negate inherent existence ultimately, whereas the middle way consequentialists, they negate inherent existence entirely. So both ultimately and conventionally. So this is where they have this major difference in terms of the object being negated. Second question is, the middle way consequentialists assert two sets of three ways that phenomena do not exist, to be the same or equivalent. So what are these two sets of three? Delma, did you have any luck at finding these two sets?
I think I did.
Okay.
So the first set was inherent existence, existing from their own side and existing by way of their own character.
Yep.
The other set is existing in reality, truly existing, and ultimately existing.
Okay, excellent. That's so this is how they sort of go across to each other like this. So this is just what Delmer has said. So all of these are, like I said, they are non-existence. These phenomena do not exist from the middle way consequence point of view. And this is if you just go across like this is the sort of relationship between them, equivalence in a way. Okay, so question three. So next, how do the middle way autonomous?
Sorry, Eddie.
Yep.
Eddie, just on the previous question, I had also, because it wasn't in the text and had to go looking for it, I also came across that there was something called the three ways of non-existence of the same entity. And they had the three subcomponents of phenomena do not exist as the same entity because they lack inherent existence. They are not identical due to their causes or conditions, and they do not possess an intrinsic nature that makes them unchanging. And then there was the three ways of non-existence of equivalence, and it said phenomena are not equivalent because they arise dependently, they are not equivalent to their parts or aggregates, and they're not equivalent to their labels or designations. I just thought I'd share that, Eddie.
Okay. So how do the middle way autonomous assert the way objects exist? Chris, would you like to answer that one?
Yes, so the autonomous assert the way objects exists by way of the object's own mode of being from its own side and exists without being imputed by an undamaged awareness.
Okay, and so what other terms did they use there to this is all correct.
By their own character, they also use the word character.
Yep, so we've got nature, character, and inherent. So these are how these phenomena exist from the middle way autonomous point of view. You also know, don't you, that these are the objects that the middle way consequence say don't exist. So phenomena do not ultimately exist like this, But they do conventionally exist like this from the Middle Way autonomous point of view. Is that clear to everybody?
Yeah, I think the that's the key thing about, because otherwise it's really confusing that, you know, they talk about conventionally things inherently exist and then ultimately they don't inherently exist. That's so you right. have to be really clear, are you talking ultimately or conventionally?
That's exactly right, Caroline. That's right.
Sort of did your head so, in a bit.
I mean, if you just go to the Middle Way Consequence School, you just know, right, none of these things exist at all, neither ultimately or conventionally. So that's the simple one, straight up. And then if you sort of back through all the way back, there's this thing of inherent existence or self-sufficient existence, all these different terms, right? And all those other schools are saying they exist in some way like that. So, and just like you said, so then we have the Middle Way Autonomist, and they're going, yeah, they exist way conventionally, but not ultimately. So that's the simple way to get your head around it, I think. Middle Way Consequence, very straightforward, none of these. Either conventionally or ultimately, Middle Way Autonomy, conventionally. So now, interesting question. So what result arises from the Middle Way Autonomists not being able to correctly identify the object to be negated? So, Caroline, I'll give you that one, even though you haven't got the answers there. You should know this one. Anyway, what do you think is going to happen? If these guys are saying, ultimately, phenomena don't inherently exist, but conventionally they do, what do you think will happen? You've got your thing off, Caroline, your microphone.
All right.
Yep, there you go.
You can't actually... negate inherent existence.
Yeah, and what's the result of that?
Well, nothing works.
Well, yeah, you stay in cyclic existence.
Yeah, right? That's right. You don't get out of get out of suffering.
Yeah,
it's just sort of you don't overcome the ignorance that is the root of cyclic existence.
Yeah, that's right. That's the outcome, right? Being unable to identify the object, the proper object to be negated, cyclic existence remains. You still have the grasping.
A really good reason for being a consequence. Consequences.
Yeah, well, you know, that's like you say, they actually identified the object, the most subtle object to be negated. Okay, then it says, would Middle Way Consequences make the assertion that phenomena do not exist from their own side without being imputed? Would they make that assertion? Linda, would they say that or not?
Yeah, which question is it? Would the Middle Way Consequences? Oh, Middle Way Consequences, okay. Yeah. So they would say, no, an object doesn't exist from the side of the base of designation.
So would Middle Way Consequences make the assertion that phenomena do not exist from their own side without being imputed?
Well, yes, they would. Sorry.
Good one. Thank you. Someone here. Yes.
I've heard that question three times. So.
Yeah, it's a bit funny way that it was worded, wasn't it? You got to sort of spell it right down, right? So the answer is yes. There's Middle Way Consequences of certain phenomena lack inherent existence and only exist through imputation. They don't exist from their own side, as we all know. Now, the next question. This is about Kamala Shiro and Baba Vaveka and this assertion they have. So one is a sutra autonomist and one's a yogic autonomist, but they both agree on what is to be negated by reason. What do they assert needs to be negated by reason? what do they assert?
Both of them say that that which is established by way of its own mode of being without being posited by an undamaged awareness is the object negated by reason.
Excellent, mate. That's exactly right. That's exactly what they say. So here's the answer, isn't it? So what's the best example to use to illustrate the position of the Middle Way autonomists about what is to be negated by reason?
They say that it's using a illusion. So like I think the example was a magician.
Yeah, they use the example of the magician creating
conjuring up an illusion of some sort. many different texts at the moment.
So yeah. The major one is this idea that they
I might be thinking of a totally different one.
Sorry?
I might be thinking of a whole different class here, Eddie.
Okay.
Many balls here, so I don't know which class actually
doing. The example they often use is the idea that you can have, like a pebble or some sticks, and the magician does this little trick, and then the pebbles and the sticks appear to be either horses or elephants. So that's the example that they often use. Anybody have the idea, what did the Middleway Consequence use?
They use the snake and the rope.
Yep, that's right. That's what they use. Yeah.
But back with the other one, Eddie, it's sort of like, I found it, well, it's sort of like they used illusion, and yet we're told when we think about emptiness is to think of it like an illusion, and yet it's saying that for the middle way autonomous example is around an illusion. But if you have to read deeply into the example, that it's, you know, you have to have the illusion, and you have to also have, you know, stuff going on in people's minds and the place and everything. So it's just, it's not as simple as illusion in the sense that we're taught to see, you know, things as an illusion. So I did wonder about that example.
So they both use illusions, but the illusions are slightly different, aren't they?
They're very different.
Illusion, but their example of the illusion is quite different.
But the snake and the rope, at least the rope actually looks like what we could label a snake. But, and there's no process of having to, magically change our mind, which is what the Middleway autonomous example, when they talk about illusion, said, that you have to have something going on with the place, you have to have something going on in the people's minds before you could get it. So I didn't quite get that.
I didn't understand it at all. I didn't understand that and how it showed up, the Middleway autonomous position, at all. I didn't understand it.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. I tried.
And
the fact that they used illusion in a very different way to how the illusion of a snake and a rope, whereas I said, you can see the shape of a snake and a rope, but it doesn't require your mind to be sort of, done magic to, which is what this illusion requires.
Mine had a little bit of information, the AI, and it said that autonomous use the illusory horse to scaffold conventional functionality, such as ethics and causality and rebirth, while guiding practitioners towards emptiness. So there's a gradual dismantling of the reification. They dismantle the ultimate truth. But of course, they leave the conventional because they want to have something that believes in causality and rebirth. Whereas the consequences use the rope snake to uproot all reification, exposing phenomena as mind-dependent illusions. So that's what just my AI came up with, the difference why these analogies matter. Because it's the snake and the rope gives the immediate eradication of subtle grasping, whereas the illusion with the horse only does the gradual dismantling of the reification.
What does that mean?
Yes, it'll probably be a good idea to, again, so this is the sort of thing where AIs can be very useful here, where you ask it to explain it to you as if you were 10, and then gradually bring it back up until you can go, oh, okay, I get it.
I think it's because the reason that the consequences still hang on to the conventional is because they've got to have something that tells about conventionally exist inherently, because they believe in, they've got to have something that proves karma and rebirth. So for them, that's why they still hold on to it.
You meant autonomous there, Sue, did you?
Autonomous. Yeah, that's why they hold on to the conventional reality, because they believe that's got to happen. And to me, just even having that little sentence helped a little bit in reading through everything. So,
Yeah, it brings another layer that at least that didn't rely on the magic and having, you know, like the whole thing about relying on, you know, changing your mind. That was the thing that I couldn't get about the example, but yeah.
To me, the difference between the two was that with the example of the magician, it's there's sort of like an agreement between the magician and the audience that they're going to see something that doesn't actually exist, but they agree to believe their eyes. Whereas it's not with the snake and the rope, it's a bit different. It's still a case of do you believe what you see, but what you see is not a confection like it is with the magician.
Yeah, that's good, Bruce, because I think with the conventional reality of that, for the autonomous, it exists inherently because it depends on the causes, and those causes inherently exist. So that's all the causes are everything that's happening in the magician's process. But whereas the consequence with the rope and the snake, it exists only by imputation. So it's a mind-based thing. It's a different thing. But for the conventional reality, they're agreeing on it because they agree that everything exists inherently and depends on these causes, and these causes do exist.
But again, but that's not going to be the people in the audience, though. Like it's sort of, you know, if you take it literally about the people in the audience, you know, might agree that they're going to see an illusion. Like, you know, every time you talk about a magician and an illusionist, I think of seeing David Copperfield.
And so when you saw David Copperfield, the illusion existed, didn't it?
Yeah, but it wasn't about sort of, you know, a horse came out of nowhere. It's about he distracted your attention.
Yeah, the horse hasn't come out of nowhere.
Well, there was no horse, but, you know.
So what's for the requirement for the horse to appear, what's required?
Well, for
causes
you to...
Causes and conditions.
Yeah, what are they?
Don't know.
The stone. Remember the twigs. You had to have the twigs and the stone that was there first. That's what actually exists. That's like the cause actually inherently existent. But the horse doesn't. That's the illusion.
Yeah, but you just sort of rationally, you can't get from twigs to a horse unless you're just sort of hypnotised.
If you were the magician, you could.
Yeah.
And they're also talking about using mantras and spells in this as well.
Yeah, that's right.
We're not talking about ordinary beings here. We're talking about, you know, the great masters who've got that ability, like what was his name? Milarepa had, you know, could use those.
Yeah, if you take it back to like what Caroline was saying, it's a bit more simpler than that, Delma. It's like you have a person like David Copperfield, right? So when he does this thing, you actually see the horses and the elephants, right? They walk through space. They're up there on tight wires, all sorts of weird things, right? You actually see it. But is there a horse or an elephant up there?
No.
No. Mm. But that for that horse or elephant to appear up there, it's dependent upon some things. And so those things must be real. That's dependent upon.
No, right, yeah.
And this is what Sue's saying. These things that are real are the causes and conditions. They're inherently real. They must be real. They don't exist like the horse does. There's something real.
Yeah. And my husband worked it all out because he spent the entire trip home telling me exactly how he did every single illusion.
Well, there you go. That's right.
So, yes, there were causes and conditions that my husband saw through that I didn't. And he was right in how he did them all.
Okay. Now, this next question is not so easy to do. It asks for an appropriate outline. So was anybody able to come up with an outline? I was thinking maybe you would, Sue. But did anybody else come up with an outline? So I'll take that as a no.
No.
Okay.
What were you meaning by an outline was my question, I guess.
So why are these, the outline was for why the examples are appropriate. So you had to go through, like, present a step-by-step process.
I've got one for the snake and rope.
Okay.
Or have a go. If you were to search in a rope for a snake, you would not find any snake whatsoever. Just as if you were to search within the basis for imputing things, you would not find the imputed object whatsoever.
Okay, so I'll make it. So this is where, again, this is where an AI is really useful, right? So they could just put in, create an outline and put all this material in, and it'll pop up an outline. So the first thing it begins with, of course, is we're talking about the object of negation. That's what we're all talking about here. We have to identify the object of negation. Then we find these examples used by the middle way autonomous in particular. Then why they justify the examples is what we've been all talking about, trying to go like why they use these phenomena and so forth. And then there's the conclusion. You know, that was a simple way of coming up with it. So in other words, you're going through all this material we've just gone through. And this one was for the middle way autonomous. As you see later on, there's another one for the middle way consequentialists. We're going to get more information. So this material is getting even more and more difficult, isn't it? Is anybody, like, if you're reading through Geshe Sopa's material, it's like, wow, man, all these words, it's just like, and trying to hold it together. And then, of course, then you go back to Kensa Rinpoche's commentary, and there's all this material in there about the reasoning. And there's not much of that within the Geshe Sopa material. So it's not so easy to understand anymore. So like I said, so this is the sort of thing where an AI is quite useful when you can just start making it a bit dumber. Like say, explain it to me as if I were 12 years old or 10 years old or 16 years old, until you sort of lose the thread and you can go back and backwards and forwards and go, oh, I can see what's going on here. Because just as we are, I think it'd be near impossible. And it's maybe if you had someone like Venerable Sewang sitting beside you and going through the text bit by bit with you and explaining it, breaking it apart. So let's see, we'll just put that aside for the moment. And is there anything anybody would like to say?
Sometimes I find it's actually easier to actually skip a lot of the dialogue in the commentary and actually try and find the summary, Geshe-la's summary. And then try and get my head around that and then go back and read the rest of it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it just doesn't really make any sense.
I do it, I do it a little bit different. I go and get all the answers first, then I go back through it, right? And you go, now I've got something to hold on to as I go through. And like you're saying, Dalma, then you've got all these conversations and, you know, they have something to do with something, but not necessarily the answer that I'm looking for with the question. Yeah, that have to do with other things. Anyway, let's do a meditation and we'll take the next little bit. So just get yourself comfortable. Let your body breathe itself. And then just generate a motivation to try and understand emptiness. Not only for your own liberation, but for the benefit of all sentient beings. So the key distinction between the autonomous and the consequentialists lies in identifying the object to be negated. Autonomous accept conventional inherent existence. Consequentialists reject it entirely. It's a bit like treating an illness, right? So the autonomous address the symptoms at the surface, whereas the consequentialists target the underlying root causes. Remember, this is an analogy. So now how do we project inherent existence onto phenomena in daily life? So how do we project inherent existence onto phenomena in daily life? Well, perhaps we see objects existing from their own side. Perhaps we see objects appearing to be independent or not dependent upon our senses. Perhaps phenomena appear to have their own characteristics. But a deeper analysis will reveal interdependence. If we could recognize emptiness, how might this transform the challenges we have with the appearances of inherent existence? And how about the challenges that we face every day? We see them as inherently existent. What might we do if we knew they were actually empty of that inherent existence? Well, I think we'd hold phenomena lightly. We would not cling to the phenomena, nor would we cling to our conceptions of them. So what might shift if we aimed to dismantle this subtle clinging? Well, our practice would become a tool for liberation and even enlightenment, if it were bound with the mind of enlightenment. So perhaps we could commit ourselves to examining the object's dependent nature. Because understanding emptiness opens the door to compassion and freedom. And through us trying to understand emptiness, trying to understand that all phenomena lack inherent existence, this is a step towards our own development of wisdom and liberation from suffering. Now breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. And let your eyes blink open if they're closed. Let's have our little break now. So we're up to question 9. So I've got about like another 10 questions to go. That's okay, mate. This next section is quite easy compared to what we've just gone through. Yeah. Okay, let's have a look now. Then let's go on. So here they're looking for the middle way. What's the best example to use to illustrate the positions of the middle way consequentialists about what's to be negated by reason? So, of course, this we use this reason itself, we use dependent arising. The example used, of course, is a snake superimposed upon a rope. Now, again, it's a difficult one. I don't know if anybody could have done this. We have to provide an outline explaining why these examples were appropriate in terms of the middle way consequence. Again, you have to begin with identifying the object of negation. It's all about that. then looking at the example used here, so we use the example of snake superimposed upon a rope and not the conjured horse. All phenomena depend upon their different conditions. And then we refute the autonomous assertions. So the consistency with Buddhist philosophy and understanding the two truths, applying it practically, and there's a conclusion. So all of this is in this type of, all the material that we've just sort of gone through. And again, of course, I couldn't come up with this myself. I had to put all the material in and then say, create an outline that would facilitate understanding. And this is what it came up with. So here we start, it's getting easy now, right? So who is asserted by masters like Jetsumpa as the trailblazer for the Middle Way Consequence School? So who's the trailblazer? Anyone? Everyone knows, don't they?
Chandrakirti.
Yeah, that's right. They assert Chandrakirti as being the trailblazer. Now it's interesting to say why. Why does Jetsumpa assert this? Bruce.
Chandrakirti explains the consequence position through a refutation of autonomous arguments. Basically that he refuted autonomous arguments.
Yeah. And he replaces it with sort of what they call a reductio ad absurdum, isn't it? Okay. Meaning consequences. So he refutes the autonomous arguments and then clarifies the middle way consequence position.
So is it saying, Eddie, that because he used that whatever means consequence, that the consequence school is actually named after, the, you know, he first used the word consequence?
Yeah. I think that, yeah, became the main thing.
Yeah.
And so, of course, it is adopted as the main methodology. Even though they do use reasoning, of course, as you see again and again throughout Gessler's text. But you got your microphone on, Caroline.
It's the consequences of when of the result of the logic and reasoning application.
Yes, that's right.
I found it interesting. I went right back to one of our very first classes where we actually did the map of all the lineage holders.
Yeah.
And Chandrakirti's not even on that.
No, that's right.
One of mine. So where does he fit in? Does he fit in before Lama Atisha in writing, like in... So it sort of goes from Asanga and Nagarjuna and then down to Lama Atisha. And I wasn't real sure where he fits in,
find the dates. But the thing is, he'd come out with his presentation and it hadn't been accepted in Tibet for a long, long time. So I feel like 600 years after he'd actually come out with it. Yeah, so it wasn't, and it wasn't, you know, when the Buddhism came into Tibet, that was not the prominent way of bringing, you know, Chandrakirti did not bring in Chandrakirti's methodology when Buddhism was first brought into Tibet. Yeah, so it's quite an interesting study if you look at it historically, Dalma. So now I've got this question. It says, when Buddha Palita said that things are not produced from other, what did he mean? So, Dalma, would you like to have a shot at this one?
Sorry, which one was it?
Question 13, he says, when Buddha Palita said that things are not produced from other, what does he mean?
He means that if there's nothing that's ever been produced ultimately, how could something be produced from something else?
Could you just say that again?
He means that if there is nothing that has ever been produced ultimately, how could something be produced from something else? And he also demonstrates that each of the four possible means of arising has unacceptable consequences for those who hold that to be true.
Okay, so I want to hear it like simpler.
Simpler? Yeah. Well, I've got a whole paragraph, so I'll...
So without looking at the paragraph, just tell me what it means, simply.
Well, how can something exist conventionally if it doesn't exist ultimately?
Okay. Chris, what do you think? What's a simpler way of looking at this? What's he mean when he says things are not produced from other?
It simply means it's produced from self. Therefore, it inherently exists.
Okay. Caroline, any idea?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
It had the paragraph with the four ways of production, but it didn't explain them.
Okay. So we've done this. This has been covered many classes back. Linda, what do you think? What's he saying here?
No, I stopped halfway through the questions. I stopped at question six, thinking we'd only doing half of them.
So. Okay.
I've got a bit more. It says that there's no sense in which anything that has ever been produced, either from itself or from something else, from both, or without a cause. Nothing's been produced that way.
What way?
From either itself or from something else. Or from
aren't things produced from something else? Aren't tables produced from wood?
Yes. Without a cause. They have to have a cause. That was the end of my sentence. All those things have to have a cause.
Okay, so did I ask you, Bruce, what do you think this means simply?
I'm not sure. I think maybe talking ultimately.
Produced. So things are not produced from an inherent other. It's inherent is what everybody's missing. Things are not produced from other inherently or from an... If you have something that inherently exists, it cannot produce anything else. That's what he's saying. If you've got something that inherently exists, it cannot produce something other. This is a you remember this was a refutation of the four extremes, wasn't it? Not from itself, not from other, not from both, not without a cause whatsoever. So all these things, the extremes are inherent existence. This is a bit like the Heart Sutra, you know, where they don't put in inherent existence. It's the same thing here. So you've got to remember, when they're making shortcuts here, it's all sort of based around this object of negation, which is inherent existence. So they've just sort of left it off. But for us, who are sort of new to it, it's very easy to think just produced from other, like ordinary other, conventionally other. They're not talking about conventional other. Because things are produced conventionally from other things, aren't they? So it can't be that. It has to be inherently existent other. So a cause that is inherently produced. Something can't be produced from an inherently existent cause. And that's why I put this picture here, like it produces, you know, like not produced from itself. So you get just itself. And you don't get other, which is like the same, but other. So that doesn't happen either. So this is what it means.
So Eddie, are you saying in that question would be reworded to say that things are not inherently produced from an other inherent object?
That's phenomenal. That's right.
Phenomenal.
That's
okay.
Right. That's what it's getting at. That's exactly what it's getting at, Thelma. Yeah. Okay, so then we have our next one. And why does Baba Vaveka disagree with this? So, baby, Chris, would you have a go at this one? Oh, perhaps you made a stop by now.
Yeah, I would just... I recall Baba Vaveka is from the autonomous school. Eddie, so he would say conventionally, though, things do inherently exist, although ultimately they don't. And that's where you'd get the clash between the two.
Yeah, that's right. That's great, Chris. It's just like that. So basically, so Buddha Palita, because he's using the method of the consequences, right? So he just proves the consequence. So this is not suitable for Baba Viveka. Remember, he was saying, so where's the reasoning here? There's no autonomous reasoning. There's no example given. So I can't accept it. It's not being proven to me. Again, you've got this difference between the what's what I call proofs. So the middle way autonomists are not accepting the methodology of that the consequentialists are putting forward. Baba Viveka argued that when one refutes production from other, remember here that production is from an inherently existent other, one must add the qualifier ultimately, meaning that one should refute production from other ultimately, as things do exist in a conventional sense. He maintains that while Buddha Palita's arguments were meant to demonstrate the faults in the position of others, they did not effectively establish his own position. In essence, Baba Viveka contended that the reasoning provided by Buddha Palita did not hold up under scrutiny, and that his arguments failed to effectively counter the positions of those who asserted a form of production from other. And this disagreement highlights the fundamental differences between their interpretations of the nature of existence and the validity of certain arguments in the context of this middle way discourse. So anything you'd like to ask or say about this material?
They were talking about syllogisms.
Yeah.
I had to go and look that word up because I had no idea what it meant. Yeah. So they're basically saying that they're both schools of the middle way autonomous are actually drawing a conclusion from different positions. Some of it's got common ground with middle way consequence, but their conclusions are actually mistaken. Is that how
so I should say something about this? So where the middle way consequences really go against the middle way autonomous. So you know both sides use reasoning, right? And you'll see a lot of the material that Geshe-la would talk about in his in the commentary, there's lots of reasoning in there, and there's lots of it with these syllogisms. So if you look at it, you go like, so what's the difference here? What's the problem? Is anybody able to sort of like found out what it is? There is a difference between the middle way consequence and the middle way autonomy.
The middle way autonomy accept more or less that there's valid cognition for the reason, the predicate, you know, and the position property, that they are all established by valid cognition by everybody. Whereas the consequence school says you can't say that, that it's necessarily established by valid cognition. And initially you might need a consequence to get rid of a wrong or absurd wrong view or a wrong holding or a wrong grasping. You use a consequence to get rid of that, and then you can state a correct reason.
So so within what you're saying there, Sue, is this nugget of truth that's for me is like the simplest thing, right? And that is the criticism that the middle way aim at the middle way autonomous is that the reasons inherently exist.
When you say reason, do you mean the full three parts of a reason?
Yeah, that's right.
Three
parts. And that's what comes out. You know, when you said just a minute ago, Sue, that everybody has to agree?
Yes.
And in the middle places, well, we can't. We can't agree with that because phenomena don't inherently exist.
That's right.
That's the big thing. It's, you know, you might have found it yourself when you argue. I found it myself. When you argue with people, you find that if you're not both on the same page, you know, like it's a big mess, isn't it? You know, you sort of both argue to get the other person to agree with you first, and then you can get into it, and you know, you're going to win, right? But phenomena don't exist like that. So this is the major thing. The middle way, again, like this idea of this valid consciousness and these parts of the reasoning, they intrinsically exist. That's how we see you guys seeing it. Well, we can't go along with that. Because they both use the reasoning, don't they? They both use the three parts, as Sue pointed out, all these sort of things. It's not the problem with the syllogism itself. It's like, how does it exist? And we take it that you guys are saying these things, reason, it has this inherent type of existence. So they know. And then they say, like, from a middle way consequence perspective, it doesn't have to. That's the brilliant thing about using consequences. We don't have to agree with, you know, like it's this way. All we've got to do is point out the absurdity. So I know, like in next week, the next couple of weeks, the next two teachings we do, they're really basically all around this. We don't really move very far, and then Geshe-la comes back again. Right? So it's like, oh my gosh, like we're in the same place basically. So we're going over it and over it again, and hopefully it'll become a little, you know, more will be drawn out for us, and so we can see it a little bit more clearer. And I know that one of the questions in there was really lovely. There's a section there where Geshe-la asked, one of the questions is, so show it like the way, take this reason and show us how the autonomous would do it and then how the consequentialists would ask it. And so that's quite, you might find it interesting yourself when you come across it. But let's do this meditation and then we'll move on. Again, just get comfortable in your seat. Let your body breathe itself. And I think that you're going to do this meditation and this study to bring about your enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Now, if your eyes are open, just look at anything and ask yourself, does that object appear to not be dependent upon my senses? And if your eyes are closed, then just allow a thought to arise. And when it does, ask yourself, does that thought appear to exist from its own side? Does it appear to be just there? Now, even though I've thought it, does it appear to be existed without me having thought it? This is how objects appear to exist from their own side. To exist from its own side means they exist inherently. Now, although they will always appear to us as inherently existent, we have to understand that they don't actually exist in that way. So like a person mistaking a coiled rope for a snake in dim light, we project inherent existence onto phenomena that are merely empty appearances. Thoughts are wonderful examples of this. Now think of something that you really cherish, you really like, which you wouldn't want to lose. Does its identity not appear to you to be inherently or intrinsic? Does it not seem to have its own identity, in other words? So Caroline has this little boy, I think, on her lap. Doesn't he not seem to exist from his own side? Doesn't he not seem to have his own identity? So where does this own identity reside? If you were to search through every part of that child, through its continuum from day to day, through everything it does, is there any place within all of that containing a self-established identity? So phenomena truly existed in the way they appeared to us. Intrinsically, inherently. Could they change? Could they depend upon causes? But do they change? And do they depend upon causes? So can we try to just sort of release our grip or relinquish our grip on inherent existence while engaging with conventional reality? So for us to challenge ourselves grasping at inherent reality, it might be good to commit ourselves to just investigating one object a day, searching for its supposed inherent existence. If we were to do this, we'd have greater insight into the empty of inherent existence. We would not find inherent existence. That way, we would not find all the negative qualities that we think others have. They don't exist from the side of the object. Understanding that they grasp at inherent existence probably more tightly than we do could inspire compassion from our side for them. I just sort of think, well, that's something we might try. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth. And let your eyes flutter open. Okay, so just now we've got this next section. Now this section, we'll go through, and then, like I said, so the next month or so of Geshe's teachings, they're all basically around this section here. There is about four types of misinterpretation. So the first question asks, what's the basis of the first misinterpretation by Jayananda? So, Bruce, would you like to have a go at this one?
Jayananda doesn't accept valid establishment or things being established. He's questioning how we can know if some other person has validly realized something and also that we ourselves might think we have validly realized something, but it's possible that we're deluded or mistaken.
Okay, Delma, what did you come up with? Anything?
Oh, yeah, I've got another long paragraph, Eddie.
Okay, well, really, that might be the one that Bruce has got his answer from too. Who knows?
I'm just going to do the last paragraph.
Okay.
So he says that pervasions can be established only in relation to specific places and times, but not universally. And he questions how we can know if some other person has validly realised something. So that someone might think they have validly realised something, but it's possible that they're actually deluded and mistaken, like me.
Chris, what do you come up with?
I did read this, Eddie, but I, as I said, I didn't prepare these questions, so unfortunately can't add further to it.
Of course, that's right. I'm sorry,
but also, yeah, but also feeling deluded.
Yeah. Linda, if you're there, what did you come up with, if you're there?
I am here, and I didn't do those questions, Eddie.
Okay.
I thought we were only doing half, so no.
Yeah, so this is where it gets really quite gnarly. So again, it's like this, there are four misinterpretations. And the first one is they're dealing with is this guy called Jayananda. And then the second is like, then I think we've got the students of Jayananda. And then I think, and then there's a couple of others that come after that. But the first two are Jayananda himself and then the students of him. And they're both saying, they both misinterpret what Nagarjuna is getting at, and what Nagarjuna is getting at, right, in terms of the middle way, and especially the consequences position. So simply put, Jayananda, he's basically saying, look, you guys don't have a thesis of your own. All you do is you find fault in other people. He says, so where's your, you guys don't put forward a thesis.
Who's he talking about, Eddie?
Huh?
Who's he talking about when he says you guys don't?
Consequentialists.
Radio.
Yeah.
Thank you.
He argues the middle way proponents have no theses of their own. So he says, you know, that since the elements of a syllogism, such as the subject, are not agreed upon, that is, accepted by both parties, autonomous arguments are not tenable. This is from the middle way consequence point of view. He suggests that the only result of reason analysis is that the others give up their tenets. So basically it comes down to, he's sort of saying that middle way consequence are basically rejecting the valid cognition which establishes a syllogism's three criteria. But like I'm saying, they're not. All they're rejecting is that the syllogism inherently exists. In summary, Jayananda is that the middle way has no independent assertions and can only refute what others believe, questioning the validity of the other's reasoning. So the basis of the first misinterpretation by Jayananda concerns the distinction between autonomous and reductio arguments. So the reductio arguments are the way the middle way consequentialists argue, right? They lead you into absurd positions. Jayananda misinterprets that if a proof uses a reason where valid cognition has established the three criteria, then it qualifies as an autonomous argument. So this is not what the middle way consequence school agree with at all. But this is what this fellow thinks the middle way consequentialists are doing. Caroline?
So that was what the Jayananda is saying the middle way consequence school thinks.
Yep, that's right. He's saying you guys don't have any actual, you're not putting forward a position of your own. All you guys do is shoot us down. But you remember in the text, I don't know if you come across it yet, but later on, there's a thing where Nagarjuna says, I have no thesis. And he does say that. So this guy is taking that to be like literally true. But what Nagarjuna means by it, he says, I have no thesis that exists autonomously. I don't have a thesis like that. So you know this word autonomous. Does anybody know what it sort of means? What it's getting at?
It's sort of getting at like inherent existence of conventional reality.
That's right. Not dependent. It's autonomous. It's not dependent.
Yeah, you have to keep on reminding yourself that.
That's right. Because especially for people like us, lay people, right? Who just read this a little bit and we're really struggling to understand in the first place, and then let alone to hold on to the little nuggets. Yeah, that's right. So it's not, the Middle Way Consequences do use syllogisms and do agree with the three parts and so forth. But they do not hold that these syllogisms exist autonomously. And I'll say before, you know how sometimes, well, I've noticed myself, even when we argue sometimes, I think that when I argue, the reasoning autonomously exists. It's just like, you can't see it, right? Why don't you just agree with me, right? Then we'd have this autonomous. Yeah, so this is the first, the simplest way of looking at all of this and trying to put it into layman's language, is that Jayananda is saying, you guys just refute others, but you don't have a point of view of your own. You don't have a thesis of your own.
So with them thinking like that, then valid cognition takes on a very different meaning then for the autonomous people as of the consequence people.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, valid for autonomous means inherent.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is how phenomena appear, isn't it? So why would that be valid? Anyway, so this is the first one, this simply put. I mean, there's lots of, if you go into it, there's lots of stuff like you're saying, Dalvin, you get paragraphs of this, and if you try and narrow it down, so what are they saying? Because that's what, you know, if we're going to try and make it simple for ourselves to go, Jeff, I was asked, like, what's the first misinterpretation here? What can I say? And like I said, the simplest way from this one is that he's just saying, you guys don't have a thesis of your own. You just shoot everybody down with consequences that lead to absurdities. That's all you do. And you'll see later on in the next, coming up with the next two lessons, this quote of Nagarjuna when he says, I have no thesis. And this guy's taking it like literally true. Where actually Nagarjuna means, I have no autonomous thesis. So then we have another question. He says here, now what's the main point here about what the students of Jayananda assert about the difference between middle way autonomous and the middle way consequentialists? So like I was saying, there's these four misinterpretations, and this one is by Jayananda, then the students. And I think by next week, as you'll see in your text, there's two others as well. One has to do with the way that even the people who call themselves middle way consequentialists were looking at things, and they were mistaken. Let's try this one. So anybody come up with an answer? Delma, Linda? Oh no, Linda, you stopped. Caroline, you haven't got it. Hey, Chris also stopped. So we're just going to just go through it then. Unless Bruce, what did you come up with here?
I've got an answer, but I couldn't explain it. If proof uses a reason for which valid cognition has established the three criteria, then it's an autonomous argument. If proof is made just on the basis of the parties accepting the fulfillment of the three criteria, then it's a consequence argument.
Yeah, that's right. That's basically what you're saying. That's right.
Yeah, can you explain that? Can you unpack that? Because I sort of thought this was what they were coming back to, that whole autonomy thought that things have got to be established in relation to specific times and places. Like they use the example of the smoke and the fire, seeing smoke up in the pass in the country and assuming, having a perception that there's a fire there. But that doesn't mean there's a fire in the kitchen. And
No.
I just went, what, how could you infer
That's right.
the two? It was just crazy stuff.
So, what Bruce says is probably the simplest way of looking at this. So, if a proof uses a reason which is established by valid cognition, then it is an autonomous argument. If it's based merely on what the parties accept, then it's a consequence argument. And then they follow on by saying,
But
look,
it's
if
not
you.
a, what the parties accept for the consequences, just accept. It's based on the three parts leading to the kind of result. Like if there's a
Yeah,
structure
so,
around it.
yeah, but so then, so they are using validated syllogisms, aren't they? That's right. That's right. So this is the misunderstanding that these guys are making. They say, oh, no, you just use consequences, but in fact, they're using consequences with this syllogism. And that's where you get that funny thing down where you're saying about the smoke in the kitchen, right? Because I've, so it's been, if you've been in a class where a guest that does something like this, you just get this big jolt and go, like, what are you talking about? What's that got to do with anything? And what he's done is he's thrown in the consequence of your thinking of where this will lead you to, And you go, that's impossible. And he goes, yeah. Right? So again, they've made it too simple. They've really simplified it, and they're going, and the answer is, well, no, that's untrue again. So remember here, we're always talking about misinterpretations. So again, it says, Jayananda's students understand that if a proof employs a reason validated by cognition that fulfills the three criteria, it forms an autonomous argument. If, on the other hand, the discussion merely uses criteria accepted by the debaters. Without such validation, it becomes a reductio argument, meaning a consequence argument. This interpretation underscores their perspective on how valid reasons are integrated within argumentative frameworks between the two schools. So in other words, Jayananda's students are asserting that the middle way consequentialists refute others' views without holding independent positions or valid cognitions of their own. Again, like I said, this is not true, but this is what they, this is their misperception.
So are they sort of saying that the autonomists say that valid cognitions are unmistaken and consequentialists say that valid cognitions are mistaken?
Well, that's the root of this whole argument, Delma. That's where it's all coming from. That's right. That's right down the bottom. That's the thing.
But their valid cognitions are based on inherent existence. I
Yeah, that's
mean,
right.
at the very base of it all, it's about a difference in what is a valid cognition in the sense of what evidence they accept, which is inherent existence
This,
conventionally,
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
which you have to keep on reminding yourself.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Lincoln, sir, I think, you should bring that character. Yeah, I guess that's why they spend so many years in the monasteries debating and like again and again and again, isn't it? So here we go, this next question, right? So this meaning of this no thesis. So when Nagarjuna says, I have no thesis, what does he mean?
I think he's saying that he has no thesis relating to things existing inherently. His thesis doesn't involve inherent existence. It's not that he doesn't have any thesis at all.
Yeah, it's not that he doesn't have a thesis at all. What he's saying is that his thesis has no inherent existence. Because, you know, like you're saying, there isn't anything that has inherent existence. So he rejects inherently existent thesis. And the middle way, when they look at what Baba Viveka has done, and like Sue pointed out, this idea that we're all seeing the same thing, but there's inherent existence right there. This thing that, and what's the whole thing we're seeing? Existence from its own side. So you say, like, these theses that you're putting up, they're not autonomous. They don't inherently exist. So he's saying, I don't have a thesis that inherently exists. His thesis, of course, is whatever is empty is dependently exists, isn't it? And whatever dependently exists is empty. That's the thesis. That's Nagarjuna's thesis. So when Nagarjuna says, I have no thesis, he is referring specifically to the idea that he does not hold any positions or assertions regarding things existing inherently or from their own side. He does not subscribe to any idea that would involve asserting intrinsic or essential existence for phenomena. In this context, he is not claiming to have no positions on any topic at all. And that's what the other guys make the mistake of doing, right? They say, well, this is what he said. And it's an easy enough mistake to make, isn't it? I mean, we see stuff like that, we think, oh, it means this, right? When in fact it might not. Yeah. Nagarjuna's statement that I have no thesis means he avoids fixed positions to transcend the extremes of inherent existence or non-existence. So that's what the no thesis is, right? No thesis about phenomena existing inherently, and that they don't exist. Those are the two extremes. He says, no, my reasoning doesn't abide in either of those places. So, which leads to this last question. So how is he misinterpreted? Really simply, he's got no views at all. Nagarjuna does not put forward a view. By him saying that, you know, I have no thesis. So this was, Jayananda's position at the very beginning. That was his first view, right? The very first one, the first mistake. Middle way don't have a position. They don't have a thesis.
So are they basically misinterpreting that he doesn't have a thesis on anything at all?
That's or right.
Are no, they yeah. specifically talking about inherently existent?
That's right. In fact, many of the middle way people actually held this view too, very similar. You'll see later on, as Lama Tsongkhapa points out, these people were called themselves middle way, but they weren't. But they misunderstood. So this is one of the great things you could say about Lama Tsongkhapa, this whole thing of fixing up all these mistakes, very much like Lama Ratisha did. Yeah, so Nagarjuna's no thesis rejects claims of inherent existence, not all philosophical reasoning. And then it comes this fourth misinterpretation. So he says, in the fourth misinterpretation, what is the reason given why these people believe themselves to be middle way proponents? So basically, it was very much like Dhyananda. They just, it was like this, right? So they said, look, the middle way does not hold positions of its own. It basically just refutes others. And there are many people within that held this middle way, who call themselves middle way people and held this view. So you can sort of see, I think, that there's many philosophical positions that can be taken, and they're refuted gradually over time. They're refined. But then even within people, even within schools themselves, like the middle way, consequentialist school, even those people may misidentify and misunderstand things. So this is why, like I said again, why how amazing Lama Tsongkhapa was to come and then really get into it and clarify heaps and heaps of misunderstandings. This is in the fourth misinterpretation. The proponents believe themselves to be middle way proponents because they assert that they completely reject the systems that claim the middle way has no positions of their own and no valid conditions to establish them. They argue that they can demonstrate the lack of true existence using sound reasons, even though they do not accept the existence of things inherently. They claim that by refuting the perceptual and inferential valid cognitions based on intrinsic character, they can establish their own stance without being categorized as autonomists. So this, we'll be going through this in the next month again and again. Gerson sort of goes up and he comes right back again and goes back over the material. So hopefully it'll become a little bit clearer to us. I think first time round it's just got to be really confusing.
Did you AI that answer, Eddie? Because I couldn't find any.
No, yeah. So, well, I've got a lot of books. So I put the books in. There's a lot of, so I won't use the net to do it because, I don't know, there's so much stuff out there. And you can get, so, and I've just got my, put my material in, and I only look for Galupa middle way consequence. Because the Galupa middle way consequence is different than middle way consequence. There's a whole change of what the middle way became, the middle way consequence became because of Lama Tsongkhapa. And that's the Galupa presentation of it. So there are presentations of the middle way consequence that are not Lama Tsongkhapa's presentation or the Galupa presentation. We're just going to be sort of aware of that. But yeah, so I've got my AI to just do Galupa and just do Lama Tsongkhapa. And then I'll put the text in and then, you know, let's have a look at what you've got to say. Anyway, we've come to the end of our class, folks. So we can do our last meditation and then we'll call it a day. So again, just get comfortable in the seat. Let your body breathe itself. And then with compassion for ourselves and all beings, who we recognize, see inherent existence where there is none, and grasp at it as if we're grasping at stakes on ropes. So compassion for ourselves and for all beings. We're exploring Nagarjuna's philosophy. We're trying to remain curious about how these insights might transform our own perception. So the middle way rejects inherent existence while still engaging with conventional reality through valid reasoning. And this understanding and methodology liberates us from the extremes of eternalism and nihilism. So like a bird soaring freely in the sky, Nagarjuna's philosophy remains unbound by the nets of rigid conceptual views. So how might you distinguish between rejecting inherent existence and rejecting existence altogether? Now consider how phenomena can exist conventionally while lacking inherent existence. So think about two or three conventional truths that you accept in daily life. Now, these are valid while being empty of any intrinsic reality. Now, we all are in relationship with one another and other people close to us. How might those relationships change if we thought of them to be like reflections in water? They're appearing clearly, but they lack inherent existence. So we're going to try and carry this middle way perspective into our interactions. We want to recognize both conventional reality and their ultimate emptiness. So empty appearances. Appearances that are empty of any intrinsic nature. And breathing in through your nostrils, just exhale. Get your eyes flutter open if they're closed. A lot of questions today, and a lot of it really gnarly. But like I said, it'll come up again and again the next two times we meet. And hopefully it'll become a little bit clearer over that time. So next week, I've divided this class day 17 up into two lessons, 17A, 17B. So do you guys have the questions for 17A? Have they been sent out to you? Okay, well, I'll send those off today, and then you'll get them before we start. So a new unit starting up there. Have a look at it. We'll only be doing, like I said, half of the questions if you've got them, but you'll get new ones from me. And even though there's not many pages there, believe me, it's like, Jesus, you'll be holding your head like this going, what are they talking about? And then you read Gessler's commentary and you're even more so like that. What? I know I do. So it'll probably be the same for you.
That's not very inspiring to actually think that we're going to do this work, Eddie.
No, it's hard. It's really hard. You know, so like I said, so I've broken this next one up into two sections, and I'll have a look through these really gnarly sections, and I'll try and work out where you guys might be really stuck to, and I can break it down if you, you know, talk about it. So let's dedicate our efforts. So recollecting Rinpoche taking the time to teach us material to us, it's not common to have such in-depth explanations of emptiness and dependent arising. But I think that due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may we quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may we too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. Rinpoche, who has returned, but we just haven't found him yet, in holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request.